Long simmering debates about policing and Confederate monuments all come to a boil at once. We will hear from voices including George Floyd's family, the White House, sports leagues, and tech companies. And new job numbers are out today. Expect them to be extremely large and potentially confusing, even for professionals.
This pandemic has so many interesting caveats that will make for a great economics book in a few years.
We'll explain why it's so tricky and what to look for to understand where we are in this economic slowdown. Plus, a big merger directly connected to all that Thai food you've been ordering lately. It is Thursday, June 11th. I'm Mark Garrison with The Wall Street Journal, and this is What's News. A statue of Jefferson Davis lies on the ground in Richmond, Virginia. Protesters tore down the monument to the Confederate president overnight. It's the latest escalation in a long-running debate over remembrances of the Confederacy. It is happening in the world of sports. NASCAR now says that Confederate flags will be banned at races. It says the flag doesn't fit with the environment it wants for fans. And it goes all the way up to the White House and the Pentagon. President Trump says he will not even consider renaming 10 U.S. Army bases named after Confederate officers. This after many prominent retired generals have backed changing names. Journal National Security correspondent Michael Gordon gives us the context.
Well, this issue really has a long history. Over the last several years, every time there's been a racially motivated killing in the United States, lawmakers and even some people within the military have questioned the tradition of naming military bases after Confederate generals, because after all, they did fight against the U.S. government in the Civil War. And until recently, the Army had said, well, we're naming them after individuals. There's no racism implied here. But on Monday, the Army, through its spokesman, said it was open to considering a change. And I was told that one of the big Army concerns is, would they have support from the commander-in-chief from the White House? And it turned out that they didn't. You know, if the commander-in-chief is opposed to it, clearly the Pentagon is not about to do it.
On to the question of policing. George Floyd's brother, Philonise, testified on Capitol Hill yesterday.
George called for help, and he was ignored. Please listen to the call I'm making to you now, to the calls of our family and the calls ringing out the streets across the world. People of all backgrounds, genders, and races have come together to demand change. Honor them. Honor George. And make the necessary changes that make law enforcement the solution and not the problem.
We are reporting that the Trump administration is considering a possible executive order or other policy actions to address abuse by police. The president is in Dallas today, where he will hold a roundtable with local business, law enforcement, and religious leaders. One of the world's biggest tech companies is restricting police use of its technology. Amazon is blocking law enforcement use of its facial recognition software as questions grow about surveillance and potential bias in the algorithms. Our tech correspondent Asa Fitch explains the bigger picture.
Well, there's been a lot of pressure recently on Amazon and other tech companies to reduce or completely eliminate their sales of facial recognition technology and other products to law enforcement. And Amazon has come out very publicly in favor of the Black Lives Matter movement. And so it was particularly under pressure to do something. And so this kind of followed that pressure. IBM just this week announced that it was pulling out of this business of doing anything with facial recognition. Amazon didn't make such a strong pronouncement. It said it was suspending the use of its facial recognition products by police departments. So we'll see what happens next. There are efforts in Congress to potentially regulate this kind of technology more, and that could influence how Amazon treats it after the one-year moratorium that they've imposed.
Beyond the facial recognition issue, there's the larger question a lot of big businesses are facing up to of how to respond to the protests sparked by the killing of George Floyd. Here's Asa again.
In the broader context, what's going on here is during this wave of protests, a lot of tech companies are, you know, doing some kind of introspection and reexamination of their policies and their software and their products. And, you know, this is an example of a company that's doing that and taking action, you know, that goes beyond the simply vocal support for these things.
In a moment, why the jobs numbers are so difficult to predict in this pandemic economic slowdown and what to listen for to really understand them. Forecasters expect the latest data this morning to show 1.6 million jobless applications filed last week. But forecasters have been wrong about that lately, sometimes off by like millions. It's a reminder that the economic shutdown caused by the pandemic is like nothing before, not the last recession, not the Great Depression. But the picture is getting clearer as we go. Journal Labor economics reporter Eric Marath spoke with our Mark Stewart about why the job market is so tricky to predict right now and what to watch in the numbers we're getting.
Eric, tracking unemployment seems to be so simple on the surface, but as we have seen during the pandemic, this can be very challenging. Why is this so complicated?
Well, it's complicated because there's multiple ways these data is tracked and there's multiple different definitions. So on a weekly basis, we see unemployment claims, and that is the number of applications that have been filed for jobless assistance. So that's often used as a proxy for layoffs and unemployment, but it's flawed because we're actually tracking essentially applications, not individual humans. And that means that some people may have applied two or three times, and there's been lots of discussion about how people are frustrated. And some people may be applying even though they haven't worked in a year, and other people may have lost a job last week. So it's hard to say that the number of applications in a single week equals the number of people who are newly unemployed. The other most prominent way to track unemployment is the unemployment rate, and that's derived totally separately from these unemployment claims. It comes from a survey of 60,000 households. And the challenging part there is in times of these, especially in times of economic change, how people answer questions can really have an effect on the rate. So if for example, you aren't going to work, but you're still getting paid, that opens up a question about whether or not you are employed or unemployed. Similarly, if you expect to return to your job or not, are you employed or unemployed? And how those answers are interpreted can have a big effect on the data.
Eric, as we have seen, some well-respected economists saw a surprise with last week's numbers. How is it that even some of the smartest minds in all of this can get it wrong?
You know, it's a challenging number to predict. A lot of them were looking at the jobless claims as at least a proxy, and that suggested a much higher unemployment than the report ultimately showed. And the other thing is, it's these categorizations. So we saw and have reported that the Labor Department was forthcoming, and they said there's an error in these numbers. The unemployment rate could have been 3 percentage points higher if this classification error, and the specific error was that people who were reporting themselves as employed but not at work. And they said many of those people should have been unemployed. So usually that's a narrow category that's like, I'm on vacation for a week, so I didn't go to the office, but I'm still employed. Now there's millions and millions of people in that category, and they probably aren't all on vacation. And so they're saying that means that there should be higher unemployment. Another area is we've saw a big increase of people dropping out of the labor force, unusually high. And so some of those people may be closer to what you think of as unemployed, lost a job, hope to get another one soon. But because of this pandemic, you have this unique situation where maybe the kids are home from school. Maybe they're helping someone who's ill. Maybe they themselves are ill. And those are reasons they can't take a job. And if you can't take a job, you're not counted as unemployed. You're counted as out of the labor force.
Eric, you are in Washington. You know this beat very well. What are the questions that you will be asking when you review the data?
Yeah, so I try to take a pretty broad look at the data and not just focus on a single number and say the unemployment rate. So one of the things that I look at is also how job growth, there's job growth or fewer jobs. And that's from a separate survey of businesses. And in a lot of ways, that survey is a little bit more accurate because it's asking businesses and it covers about a third of the workforce each month. So it's actually a much larger survey. And then also businesses have a better handle of how many people they paid last week. Like they know that information. Whereas as we just discussed, if you cut a lawn for your neighbor and you got $20, are you employed? You could technically be employed because they ask you if you did at least 1 hour of work for pay. But you know, you may or may not report yourself correctly. Whereas you know, Target knows exactly how many people they issued paychecks to last week. So that's one big number. But I look at other numbers, too, including the share of people who have jobs. And I also look at the numbers of the share of the population that's in the labor force. So there's a lot of other data to look at. And then, of course, you got to look at what the BLS is telling you when they're calling out things that they're being upfront and saying this might be a mistake here. You need to pay attention to that.
And finally, Eric, we look at the unemployment numbers to get a picture of what's happening now. But can this data help shape our view or give us an indication of what's to come?
Yeah, well, and I think that's why the labor market data is really closely scrutinized, because it's kind of the seed of that the economy grows from. If people don't have jobs and they don't have income, then they can't go out and spend money. And so then some of the other data we see is affected, like retail spending and durable goods orders. You know, if you lost your job, you're probably not buying a car. And that has a follow-on effect to factories, to the person that sells you the car, to whether or not you get your car fixed. All of those things are part of the economy. And for many, many households, it all starts on whether or not you have a good, stable job. It's how you plan the rest of your life.
That was Eric Marath speaking with our Mark Stewart. Grubhub is merging with European delivery company Just Eat in a deal valuing Grubhub at $7.3 billion. For a while now, and more so during the pandemic, food delivery has been a hot space. Our markets reporter Avantika Chilcoti reports from London.
Sitting at home during the shutdown, we're all noticing how much demand there is for food delivery services. In fact, there's a lot of competition between the players as well. Earlier this year, we were reporting on Uber perhaps pairing up with Grubhub. But that deal hasn't gone ahead. Just Eat was also created out of a combination of two European players earlier this year. And the prospect of this deal suggests we could have a big global delivery company that creates tough competition for Uber.
Burning garbage is becoming more and more common in communities around the world. Our reporter Sabra Chaudhry explains why.
One of the changes that we've been seeing as waste volumes rise is that landfills, traditionally the biggest method to get rid of your waste, landfills have been falling out of favor in many parts of the world. They create methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas, which is known to contribute to climate change and global warming. And so governments in Europe in particular have set targets to limit the amount of waste that can go to landfills. And on the back of that, sending waste to incineration plants has become a much more popular option. In England, for instance, incineration is now more popular than any other option for dealing with municipal solid waste. We're seeing China build even more plants, despite having the largest number of incineration plants in the world already. And companies that operate in the US, where historically incineration has been viewed very negatively, they are saying that now in parts of the country like the Northeast, where they already have facilities, they're seeing more options for expansion. So one of the big changes that we might see is incineration really increasing its capacity in the years to come.
And that's what's news for this morning. If you like our show, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. We are back with another updated episode this evening, and there's always more on WSJ.com and our app. I'm Mark Garrison with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.